I'm Gina Giambattista, event manager, and I'm here representing Cornell University. I welcome you to this event hosted by the Cornell College Republicans, the College Libertarians at Cornell, and supported by the Ron Paul campaign. On behalf of the university, I wish to remind all participants that Cornell values responsible speech and expression and the maintenance of public order. Specifically, our campus code of conduct states that freedom to express oneself and to be heard, and freedom to assemble and lawfully protest peacefully are essential to academic freedom. These rules apply to all persons on the campus or using its buildings. Quite simply, the speaker has a right to speak without intimidation, and the audience has a right to hear what the speaker has to say. The code further states, those who dislike what an invited speaker is saying also have rights. Those who oppose a speaker may make their views known so long as they do not thereby interfere with the speaker's ability to be heard or the rights of others to listen. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to review this important information. And now it's my pleasure to introduce the New York State Regional Coordinator, David Gay.
So, who's excited to see Ron Paul? I'm David Gay, a Regional Coordinator for Ron Paul 2012. I'm just a volunteer, but if you need anything here in Central New York, email me, davidg@ronpaul2012.com. I'll be glad to help you. This is a great big crowd of Ron Paul supporters. Yeah. These are people who care about the future of this country, people who want a revival of sound monetary policy, government limited by the Constitution, and a foreign policy of freedom. We're the future of America. As a GOP committee man in the city of Syracuse, I hear it from the party all the time. We need enthusiastic young people. We need passionate people. We need energetic people. We need people with principles. Well, look around. Don't they see? That's us. We're here. We are the future of America. We've been inspired by a man of principle. A man who isn't bought by lobbyists and financial firms. A man who's remained uncorrupted in Washington, D.C. after decades there. But even more so than this, we're inspired by the ideals of liberty, peace, sound money, and life without the constant interference of Big Brother government. Much more than this campaign, it's the idea that time has come. This idea that we must never lose sight of. Now, we're 5 days away from the New York State primary for the Republican Party. Please leave no room of doubt, no room for doubt that you've done everything in your possibility to reach voters, to vote for Ron Paul in the New York State Republican primary. One of the strategies that worked for us when we basically won Iowa with delegates, one of the strategies that worked for us was the phone banking program. So visit phone.ronpaul2012.com and sign up for that program. Reach out to voters with the direct calling program. Email me, davidg@ronpaul2012.com. I'll be glad to find something for you to do here in Central New York. We have to win. After the primary, stay involved. We're seeing tremendous growth as a movement, and we will see the final victory of our revolution. And now, ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to the young man who will introduce you to the next president of the United States, a member of Cornell's own Youth for Ron Paul chapter and the president of Cornell's Young Republican Club, Raj Kanapin.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction, David. I am thrilled to be here tonight to welcome you to this special event on behalf of the Cornell Republicans, the Cornell Libertarians, and Youth for Ron Paul. Tonight is a special night because we have with us one of the few honest public officials left today, a man who has championed freedom and liberty above all else. Throughout his life, he has worked tirelessly for limited and constitutional government, low taxes, free markets, and a return to sound monetary policy. He is known for his admirable consistency, for not wavering in the face of criticism or political pressure. He has never voted for an unbalanced budget. He has never voted to raise taxes. He has never voted to raise congressional pay. And every year, he even returns a portion of his congressional office budget to the U.S. Treasury. Tonight, this man, who has given so many Americans hope for the future of this great country, will give a speech on what needs to be done to return America to its founding principles. So please help me welcome Dr., Congressman, and presidential candidate, Ron Paul.
Thank you very much for inviting me to your revolution. I want to thank David and Raj for those wonderful introductory remarks, and thank you for that very nice welcome. I appreciate that. You make it seem like we're among friends of liberty in this crowd tonight. Great. I do want to introduce my wife, Carol, who's sitting over here. And also representing our 18 grandchildren is Linda, who's a senior at Texas A&M. Linda. Now, what a wonderful, wonderful reception. And because I hold the principles of liberty so dear to my heart, it is so nice to see so many others who are joining in the cause, and thank you very much for coming out. You know, a lot of times people ask, you know, exactly what I will say at a speech, and I never know exactly what I'll say. But the story will be the same. It may come out differently, but it's always about liberty. The story about liberty and why liberty is so important. It's important if you want peace. It's important if you want a sound economy. And it's also very important to understand liberty if you want to own your life and to run your own life as you see fit. Of course, to understand that, you have to understand where liberty comes from. And one thing for certain, we do not get our liberties from our government. We have liberty in spite of the government, and we get it from our Creator. But government, very simply, in a free society, should be strictly limited. A good example of the proper role of government would be that in a free society, government should be open. There should be no secrets in government, and the government should be there to protect your privacy. Today, it's been flipped upside down. The government is secret. They don't want to tell us anything. And if we have a whistleblower who's supposed to be rewarded, is penalized, and what do they do with our privacy? They undermine our second, our Fourth Amendment, and they destroy our privacy. So what we need to do is reverse that trend. Whether it's the foreign policy, the personal liberties, or the economic liberties, we've been going in the wrong direction for a long time. There's been quite a few who have talked about these issues for a long time, people that I've read and studied over the last 30, 40 years, and it was difficult to find the information. There was only a few groups who really defended in the midst of the growth of big government. But today, the good news is it's much easier. It's much easier to find the information. There are more groups than ever, more professors, more people, even in the media, even though I'm sure you get frustrated at times with the media. But no, there's a lot more opportunity than, of course, the energy coming from the young people along with the internet. We have a great team going for the cause. But the enemies of liberty know that the true friend of liberty and spreading a message is the internet. And there has been quite a few in Washington, under the United Nations, internationally, that would like to remove this wonderful vehicle for us to communicate. And of course, a few weeks ago, there was a bill on the House and the Senate floor, the Stop Online Piracy Act, which once you discovered that, a few messages were sent out, and all of a sudden there was a response in Washington. Guess what? Members of Congress took their names off the bill, and the leadership was forced to remove that bill from the House floor. That, of course, is the good news, and they removed that bill, and it's good news that the system still works. When the people become irate, that irate, tireless minority can be heard by galvanizing a lot of people, and we can achieve things to a relative sense in Washington, D.C. But the very bad news is they're at it again. They have another bill coming up, not only equally as bad, but maybe worse, and they're playing off, well, we solved all the problems with the last bill, and now they have a bill, the letters is CISBA, CISPA, which means that if you want your privacy, if you want to protect the internet, get to your members of Congress and get to your senators and tell them you don't want that bill. But no matter what they try to do, they cannot stop an idea whose time has come. And the ideas of liberty, the time has come, and we will not be silenced. Now, they claim that our campaign has been rather silent. You read articles day after day. Where has Ron Paul gone? What is he doing? No, we don't hear anything from him. But guess what? Do we hear and see crowds like this on national television say, our campaign is alive and well and gathering up the delegates that we need? Where has the media gone on reporting what's happening in this country? Now, I venture to guess most of you know about a bill called National Defense Authorization Act and a provision in that. But did the national media help you find that problem and identify it? It's never been on national TV. It has essentially never come up in 22 debates for presidency in this campaign. It was mentioned about that much, and I had about 15 seconds to respond to it, very, very minimally. So we know we can't depend on what we read and what we hear on television. And I think what is happening is that the establishment politicians, and even those who are in charge of the media, they don't understand how extensive and how energized this revolution to return our liberties really is. So we must continue and never give up, because giving up will not be a good message for America or for liberty. You know, there was a bill passed recently, and they were emphasizing those individuals who are protected by the Secret Service. You know that I did not accept protection from the Secret Service. And I cannot say that I predicted that there would be a scandal in the Secret Service, but it was not hard to predict that government agencies have a tendency to self-destruct, and this is just another example. But people in politics think they're very special. They don't think of themselves as average people. So there's a law that the politicians passed that said that anybody who gets within a certain distance of an individual who's protected by the Secret Service can be arrested for demonstrating, even if it's just holding a sign up, and they can get 10 years for that. You know, there's a statistic out that shows that we have 5% of the population of the world, and we have 25% of the world's prisoners. So what does that mean? Does that mean the Americans are bad people? Or does it mean that we have way too many nonsensical laws on the books? On January 1st of this year, the same day that National Defense Authorization Act came into effect, there were 40,000 other new laws placed on the American people. I don't think we needed, if there were any of those necessary, I haven't discovered them yet, but I would like to be our first president that would actually eliminate 40,000 laws off the book. Some that would head the list. To start off with, a president could do that. They can use the executive order, not to pass new legislation. I think it's wrong. It's not authorized for the president to legislate with executive orders. But it would be proper for a constitutional president to use an executive order to repeal the executive orders that did illegal legislation. This, of course, would eliminate an executive order the president signed just a couple weeks ago. There's the Defense Appropriation Act. It has a new name now, but it was an act that was passed in 1950. It essentially gives a president the power to socialize and control all of industry, all finances and all businesses. It's total control. They never invoked it, but I just wonder what's going on, because this time it wasn't passed by the Congress to renew it. It was passed by an executive order. And there were a few changes. The most significant change that was made by the executive branch was it wasn't in times of war that they could execute these powers, but in times of peace as well. Those kind of things are on the books now. And because they're on the books and they're not knocking on our doors and doing things doesn't mean that we should ignore it. Matter of fact, we shouldn't ignore it. We should not be complacent. We should know what's going on. We should know what the Defense Authorization Act really means. And that bill actually authorizes the military to arrest American citizens. repeals the concept of posse comitatus, but it's not only the arresting of American citizens that's so bad about that. It explicitly says if you're arrested under those conditions, they can prevent you from getting an attorney. And it also says that you can be put in prison indefinitely in a secret prison. And they call that part of America. If we're going to have a republic, if we're going to have a return of freedom in this country, that stuff needs repealed and taken off the books. Also, in the last couple of years, it's been the law, because of an executive order, that the president can decide on certain circumstances to assassinate American citizens. They were complaining the other day about the president overstepping his bounds and lecturing the Supreme Court. I'll tell you what, that was rather minor compared to him declaring himself the prosecutor, the judge, and the executioner just on his own. So these kind of changes, of course, they haven't been used that much, just on a few occasions, but it's the precedent that counts. And the argument is, well, these are bad guys, but they've never been charged with anything. They were never given a trial. We don't know that. But precisely if they were bad people, they deserve the trial for our benefit. If Timothy McVeigh was able to be tried, I think that anybody should be able to be tried. What about the war criminals after World War II? They were at least given a trial. Adolf Eichmann, years later, was arrested and taken to Israel, and he was given a trial. But this idea that there's enough power because they so-called a bad person is something that has to be reversed. We cannot ignore it. I'm always delighted that when the crowds that come out are very numerous and you know about it. So that means this information is not being kept secret. It is out in the open, and that once again emphasizes the fact why we have to keep the internet free and that we have access to it. The president hasn't been a friend to civil liberties, although he claimed he would be. The Congress has not been defending our civil liberties. They passed, the law to allow these arrests. But also, this week, the Supreme Court had a ruling. It was a 5-4 ruling that said that anyone who has been approached by a police officer can be strip searched without probable cause. So there are a couple things that that symbolically at least, that has to be changed. Is one, the symbolism that we see on television and all the pictures of what happens at the airport and the groping of the TSA agents and the x-rays. If we put up with that and not say no more, there's something wrong with us if we tolerate that. Attack on civil liberties has been going on for a long time. They've got much worse in the last 10 years, especially since 9/11. It was shortly after 9/11. Understandably, we were all very, very concerned about what was happening, but I don't think the analysis was very good. It was considered almost treasonous to suggest that maybe 9/11 had something to do with a phenomenon described by the CIA and the Defense Department, the thing called blowback. Maybe that had something to do with it. But instead of addressing the problems that we have with our foreign policy and see the connection, the attack and the correction has been the attack on the American people. So the first bill that passed after 9/11 was the Patriot Act. So that too should be high on our list for repealing legislation. But When that bill was being passed, I remember it clearly because I was sitting on the House floor talking to another member. There weren't very many of us that voted against it. So he was obviously voting for it. I said, "Why are you voting for this?" He says, I said, "You probably haven't even read it because it'd only been out on the floor about an hour or so." He says, "Oh, no, I haven't read it." And I said, "You know, it'll probably have a lot of bad stuff in it." He said, "Yeah, I know that too." And I said, "Why are you going to vote for it?" He said, "Because it's called the Patriot Act." He says, "How can I vote against the Patriot Act under these conditions? What would I tell my people back home?" I said, "Well, that's your job. You go home and explain it to them why you need to vote no on it." But I'm sure you're aware of the fact that if you see the title of a bill going through the Congress, it probably has a title that is exactly opposite of what it's going to do. So if the bill had said repeal the Fourth Amendment, maybe they wouldn't have gotten so many votes for that. So next year or so, we have that chance. The bill will say restore the Fourth Amendment Act and repeal the Patriot Act. But there are various reasons why there's been a systematic attack on our liberties. One is that, and one that none of us like to admit, it's a lot our fault. We've been careless. We've been apathetic and lackadaisical about it, and they do these things, and we don't hear about it, and they've gotten away with it. That is what I think is changing. I don't find people like you in an audience like this as being lackadaisical when it comes to protecting freedom, and that's the good news. But certainly, the one item that we have been pursuing now, essentially since the early 70s, has to do with the enforcement of drug laws. And that has led to a couple things. First, we spend a lot of money, probably $3 to $4 trillion. Second, hasn't done any good whatsoever. Matter of fact, I think that war on drugs is more dangerous than the drugs themselves. Certainly has made for danger on our borders, on our southern border. There was like 50,000 people got killed over drug wars over the last 5 years or so. So it is very, very dangerous. But it's dangerous to our liberties. It's these SWAT team operations, dozens and dozens, they claim every single day around the country at all levels of government. And it's always to do good, to make people behave and make sure that they don't hurt themselves. At the same time, they're destroying our liberties and undermining and not solving their problems. Drug usage hasn't been solved, the problem of drug usage. Matter of fact, drug addiction is much worse with prescription drugs than it is with the illegal drugs. And I'm sure you've heard the many stories when SWAT teams barge in and break the doors down. Lo and behold, sometimes they go into the wrong apartment, and sometimes they kill innocent people, and sometimes they destroy property. And yet, we're supposed to accept that? I say no, we shouldn't accept that. We should accept only the protection of our liberties from our government. That is what we should be doing. But another downside on the enforcement of the drug laws is that I consider this one area where there's still a lot of discrimination in this country. There's a lot of talk about the race wars going on and the fighting and the squirming around. But sometimes I think they miss the point where real discrimination occurs. And I believe it's the enforcement of the drug laws. I believe that if you're poor and a minority, you're more likely to be arrested and imprisoned and fined and penalized compared to if you happen to be a celebrity and you have money and you're of a different color, you have a different way of getting around the system. So So one of my daydreams have been, and I think it's still possible it's going to happen, is just like in the 1930s, the early 1930s, the country woke up and said, you know, this prohibition of alcohol is for the birds. Let's repeal prohibition. And that, of course, is what we should do. But the point about drugs is a bigger point than just the drug issue. It's about liberty. Who is supposed to be responsible for your safety and you taking care of yourselves and what habits you have? Now, if you use drugs or alcohol, obviously, if you do harm to others, you need to be penalized. You need to be in prison or whatever. But if somebody is using drugs and the government comes in and causes all this harm, this is a different problem. I, for one, think drugs are very, very dangerous. Matter of fact, not only do I think the so-called illegal drugs are dangerous, I think the legal drugs are very dangerous, too. I happen to think that we use too many. But, you know, there is one area of drug usage which opens the door more to a better understanding, and that is the states that want to and have legalize the medical use of marijuana. Now, I put that in the same category as freedom of choice on you deciding whether or not that might help a person medically, as I would say that you ought to have the right to make your own decision on whether or not you want to drink raw milk. But it really goes back to who's to protect us from ourselves. It is only us that can do that. Everything that we do, every habit we do, everything that we eat, drink, smoke, or whatever, it is up to us. But it's up to us also to teach our children or the doctors or the community, try to instruct and show where the danger is. But to say that the nanny state will solve our problems and let the government and the bureaucrats and the regulators spend $3 trillion in the last 40 years and have no success, it's time to call it off. It's time to call it off. A lot of people worry about this idea of legalizing freedom because they might misuse their freedom. And then they'll say, well, if they misuse their freedom, then they will become a ward of the state. Well, maybe that's the problem. Because if you alone suffer the consequences of making mistakes, it's a lot different than if you become a ward of the state. You can go to your neighbor, your government, and say, you take care of me because, you know, I didn't wear a helmet, and therefore you have to take care of me, and that's when you depend on the government to solve all our problems. But the whole idea, though, is allowing us the right to our life. We know where our liberties come from. We know where our life comes from. We certainly ought to have the right to deal with the fruits of our labor and keep the fruits of our labor. But a lot of people have trouble with that. And what happened 100 years ago is somebody along the way philosophically took something that the founders gave us, and that was a unified concept of liberty. That economic liberty and personal liberty was one and the same because they're right to your life. So now we have some people mildly defending economic liberty and in a very confused manner, and another group poorly defending the rights of individuals to run their life as they choose. But it's one and the same. If you have a right to your life, you have a right to your social values, your church values, and all your habits that you do, and you have a right to keep your money and spend the money that you have, waste your money if you want to, but the consequence then only falls on you. But if you turn those responsibilities over to the government and the bureaucrats, it costs you a lot of money, and they don't solve the problem one bit. So I don't have very much faith or confidence in a politician. One thing that I think is so wonderful about this message is that if you understand liberty, all of a sudden it brings diversity, it removes diversity, or brings diverse people together, not because they want to use their liberties exactly the same way. We don't all want to go to the same church. we don't all want to read the same books. We don't all want, we shouldn't all want to have, you know, enforcement of our same habits, and we shouldn't have the government enforcing us how to spend our own money. So the problem, though, is some people will say, yeah, I like this idea to a certain degree, but sometimes people just abuse these personal liberties, and they practice bad habits, and we have to take care of them and prevent them from hurting themselves. What they're saying is they think that if you're allowed to make your own choice and you make a choice that they don't like, that you've endorsed what they do. But that's not the case. If somebody takes the First Amendment and they practice a certain religion or no religion, that doesn't mean you endorse what they do. In the same way with economic liberty. People might spend their money one way or waste their money, but you don't endorse what they do, but what you do is you have to tolerate what they do and hope that they make a good one. But why this is a magnificent message is all of a sudden, all this divisiveness in government. The divisiveness has been there generally for a long time. This group wanting power and passing on the loot against this group. But now we're broke. So now the fighting is getting very tense. That's why they don't even bring budgets up anymore, because there's nothing there to budget and we're not producing anything. So if we recognize that, if the government doesn't have anything to pass out and we're going to remove their power, then we have to bring people together, and it's the issue of liberty that should bring us together. And that means that people who want to use their liberty in one way versus another way, why we should come together, and we all agree that liberty is the issue, the freedom of choice and deciding what we eat, drink, how we spend our money. Always we should come together, and then we're all friends, not because we want to have the same kind of life, but we can come together because we understand and believe that people can come together and make the country a lot less divisive. Another thing that has to happen, this concept of individual liberty really has to be individual. And we use hyphenated Americans too often. If we understand what true liberty is, it's because you're an individual, not because you belong to any group. Of course, if you follow this through, you can't penalize anybody in a group because they belong to a group. They can't have unfair passage of laws or enforcement of the law because they belong to a certain group. But they should also not get privileges either because you belong to a certain group. You should have the responsibility of the individual and have the incentive and the responsibility to take care of oneself. And I believe that is the best road to peace and prosperity, and not by the government being involved in the collection of all these taxes and pretending that they can fairly distribute this and take care of everybody, and it ends up in a dogfight, and that's what we're in today. That is what we have to stop. Another problem that we've had is that we drifted a long way from the concept of a republic and the concept of individual rights, because we now essentially have almost pure democracy. And pure democracy means if you can get a collection of individuals, 51%, you can remove the rights from the others, so the minority doesn't get protected. But the other thing that annoys me about that is we are going about the world pretending that we can police the world and go into nation building and spread our democratic values and American exceptionalism. We go in there, we cause a war, we take it over and say, you're going to have elections just like we have elections. Then, sometimes, we get to that point, they have an election, and they elect the wrong people, and we don't like them, so we won't accept the election. So, I have an answer for that. Why don't we just mind our own business and keep our nose out of their business? We were warned by the founders that democracy was dangerous, and they claim that democracy essentially wastes, and it consumes to the point where it self-destructs. Now, we've been wasting and we've been consuming. We're in big debt. We have a currency that has no value. There's a false illusion, a trust in our money. So we're at this point that we waste and have consumed. But the third stage, they said, was self-destruct. And I'm afraid we're on the verge of that. That is why we must get ready rather quickly to know what we're going to put in place, because if we don't change the people's attitude, they're not going to replace it with liberty. They're going to say what we need are more tyrants in Washington and more rules and regulations. They're still arguing today that the reason that we had the Depression as well as this recent recession, we didn't have enough regulations on the economy, and we didn't have the Federal Reserve regulating things quite well enough. Sounds like a very good idea. Where did you get these extreme views? What is coming up on you? Ah, that is a wonderful idea, but we don't have to worry. I'll work very hard, as I have been, to repeal the Federal Reserve Act. But to tell you the truth, they're going to self-destruct. Economic law is more powerful than anything else, and ideas are more powerful than governments, and we know that. But and we can be certain our time has come. It's been the ideas of liberty have remained dormant for quite a few years, but they're alive and well and growing rapidly, and there's a whole new generation that's joining a remnant that remembers about it, have written about it, and have left a legacy for us. So we can look to that legacy, look to that remnant as the young people come in, and we can change this country. There is no doubt about it. In the 1960s, as the Vietnam War was going on, and we were having, you know, a lot of terrible problems at that time, and the nation was even more divided today, but it was more clear-cut, liberals versus conservatives. I'm trying to change that to show that it's liberty versus tyranny. In the 1960s, there was a saying that if you weren't a liberal when you were 20, you didn't have a heart. You didn't care about people. But then they said if you were 40 and you weren't a conservative, you didn't have a brain. And I have a suggestion. Why can't you have a heart and a brain and change this system? I think that is what's happening. We're fortunate in that we have great traditions. We're unfortunate that a lot of people in this country, especially those people I know in Washington, they don't know you exist yet, and they haven't heard from us yet. That's why they have to hear from us, because they will continue to manipulate the system. But the message is loud and clear, and that's what we need to do. Now, our traditions are pretty darn good. I use the word cautiously about American exceptionalism because it's been grossly distorted. The neoconservatives claim that we are an exceptional nation and we have this moral obligation to force our way on everybody, on people, and on the marketplace, and on foreign governments because we are such a great nation. Well, I'll tell you what, there's a lot of great things about this country, especially in the past, about prosperity and individual liberty. But the best way to spread our exceptionalism that we have and can have is to set a good standard and make the world want to emulate us and not use force. That is one thing that has to be rejected in a free society, is the use of force. If you can force other people what to do, it is no longer a free society. Then if you grant this power to government, this use of force becomes very dangerous. And I think the rule that Bastiat gave us in the law is a very good rule. Bastiat simply said that if you and I can't do it to each other, that is, I can't take your car, I can't go into your house, I can't spy on you, the government shouldn't be allowed to do it either. But because of our traditions, we don't have to invent anything. We can improve on things. I talk so much about going to a gold standard, but I very rarely, and if I do say it, it might be careless. I don't want to go back to the gold standard. That's what we'll all be accused. You want to go back to the 19th century, back to the gold standard, back to the 19th century. I'll tell you what, they want to go back to tyranny, and we want to go to the future of liberty is what we want. Traditions are worth going back to and visiting and picking up the pieces because we were far from a perfect nation. But if we reject that and we don't advance the cause of liberty, then we lose out. I think the trial of liberty in this country was the best trial in the history of the world. And I'm afraid we're giving up on it. And it's going to have to be a generation of individuals that changes our mind. We have to decide what the role of government ought to be. The founders were very clear. The role of government ought to be to protect liberty. And that was it. It wasn't to police the world or tell people how to live, and it wasn't to regulate the economy. This is the reason that when I talk about being president, I talk about being a president not for the things I want to do to anybody, but what I want to not do. I don't want to be the policeman of the world. I don't want to tell individuals how they should run their lives. Only you know how to run your life. And I don't want to pretend any individual knows how to run the economy. Only the people know how to run the economy and spend their own money. What we need to do, whether it's the gold standard or the principles of liberty, our 10 amendments, we can go back and we can improve on it. One basic concept, though, that we cannot reject and sometimes we don't talk about a lot, and that is property ownership. In a free society, the maximum amount of property should be owned by the people, not the government. And today, more than a third of our country is owned by the government and continues to increase. But if you have a corporate system, corporatism, you might not have direct ownership. But today, we don't have the direct ownership, but we have a lot of bureaucratic political control locally and nationally where it's really not your land anymore and you can't do anything. You have to get permission. So true ownership doesn't exist. A lot of people worry about this and say, well, this is impossible because wouldn't this destroy the environment? Quite frankly, I don't think so at all. I don't believe that would happen. Because if you look at history and look at the movement in the last 200 or 300 years, the bigger the government, the more socialistic it is, the worse the environment was. And the basic principle that you can't harm another person, you can't take another person's property, you can't injure another person's property. You have no right to pollute anybody's air. You have no right to dump your garbage in anybody's yard. You have no right to pollute any water. And this should have been stopped during the Industrial Revolution before the corporations got together with big government and wrote the laws where they did pollute, and they continue to a certain degree. I'm just convinced that the regulatory approach at the federal level to solve that problem is not the way to go. It should be done through property ownership and this complete rejection of anybody's right to pollute somebody else's property. But the Constitution doesn't prohibit local communities to devise some regulations and rules and set some standards. So that is not ruled out. But my healthy skeptical attitude about the federal government, I don't have high hopes that that's going to work. Matter of fact, there are some people who suggested, well, the federal government isn't doing quite a good enough job on this. What we need is the United Nations taking over. That... don't need another level of government. We're trying to back off from this. So, but here we have a time where, you know, the declaration of war, our president tells us he can go to the United Nations to get these declarations. And this is not good. But picking up the pieces of liberty and marching on is a lot easier than what the Soviets had to do when they broke up and individual countries did not have our tradition. Some of those countries are doing better than others. The Russians had a tough go. But if we take the best parts we have and look at it and build on it and improve on it instead of pretending that we have to go back and live in the dark ages, this could be better than ever. And when will this, a lot of people ask, when do you think this is going to be necessary? Well, I consider the foundations of our liberties have been severely, if not completely, undermined. Our economic system is tottering because there is no sound foundation. There's no sound currencies. There's nothing but debt. There's a false trust in our currency that the world will always take our printed press money. That will come to an end. And although it has been steady, the last 100 years, the erosion of the value of our dollar went from $1 is worth about 2 cents compared to 1913. But if you study the history of money, they will destroy the value of the money, which generally means the middle class gets wiped out and wealth is turned over to a small class of people, to a minority, to the wealthy. But what happens at the end stages is the loss of confidence. And we're at that stage. The loss of confidence in the rule of law, the loss of confidence in our own government, the loss of confidence in the money, and then with the breakdown of the monetary system is a real threat. So this is why I worry at times about the Department of Homeland Security when they go out and buy $500 million bullets to put into their guns. Who are they going to be shooting at is what I'd like to know. But with our traditions and the good understanding, economic policies are better understood today. Austrian economics in the last 100 years have made great strides. It was the Austrian economist that predicted the depression. Mises predicted depression way back in the 20s, knowing what would happen. And certainly the Austrian economists were correct about what's happening now, whether it's the NASDAQ or the housing bubble. So we've made great strides. It's a lot better than even the free market economists of the 19th century. And now we're in the 21st century. So we have a lot to hold on to, a lot to build on. We have a lot of energy. You're part of it. Everybody who comes around to understanding this, just basically, guess what? A greater burden falls on you because you have more obligation. And believe me, the country is always moved by a small group of people. So if you're in that small group of people, you have a job to do, whether it's in this particular campaign or your campaign or getting yourselves involved in education. There's always a job. And I was taught a long time ago that if you do your job right and you learn the issues, you don't have to go searching for a job. It will come to you and people will come and you will know what you have to do. And I'm sure that will happen to many of you. So with that in mind and with the necessity now being clear, because it is the need that is so essential that has been discovered these last 4 years. I've been talking and visiting with people for 30 years on this, but there's something dramatically different in these last 4 years. It's because the economic crisis is real. Young people know what they're facing. They know that they have debt, no good jobs coming. You can't solve the problem with debt. The people in this country are sick and tired of the war. The time is right. This time is right for us to win this cause, for the cause for liberty, for peace and prosperity.